morning. Contrary to some rumors I heard before this talk, the title of this talk is not derived from the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie of the same title. But anyway, my name is Peter Eisentraut. I work for this company there. I was involved in the installation of various large email filter systems for companies and government agencies in Germany. And from those experiences, I also wrote a book about spam and virus filtering. It's not supposed to be an advertisement, so I'm not going to go into details. During this research and the consultancy work, I noticed some things about developments in spam and virus filtering that I really did not like, and I did not find any real thorough treatment on those, so I set out to kind of make my own notes, and this talk is sort of the byproduct of that research. So this is where we are today. It happens to be that this is the year 12 of spam, if you believe the legends that the first spam was sent in 1994 on Usenet. And this is also the year 24 of the SMTP era, based on the publication of the first RFC on SMTP. So if you count that up, then you can see that pretty much from now on, for more than half of its lifetime, email has been hampered by a spam problem. But if you think about it, just SMTP is no longer email. You cannot no longer just take an SMTP implementation and put it on the internet and hope to communicate reasonably with other people. There is now, on top of that, an additional layer of spam filter system, virus filter system, all kinds of other defense mechanisms that are essentially de facto part of the email system nowadays. Everybody has them, but contrary to SMTP and other standards, those filter systems are not standardized by anyone. Everyone can implement their own and do what they like. They're not verified by anyone. There's no accountancy of what you're doing. Most of the time, or usually, they're not even announced that they're there. So you tell people, send me email to this email address, and you say, okay, this guy probably has an SMTP server at that email address, but they're not going to tell you how they filter your email. So you really have a hard time getting your email through. And even worse, most of these filter systems are completely unpredictable by both the sender and the receiver. They consult external lists, and they have behavior changing over time based on statistical filter system and all these things that you know. So really today, getting email through is a challenge. And this talk is about why that is and what I think about that. So here are a couple of filtering techniques that people have used or that people are considering right now that I find questionable. Some of them are kind of obvious if you know them, but some of them you might wonder why they are here, and I'm going to explain why they are here. The second part of this talk is a couple of legal issues that are also of concern to me. But first, the technical side. So the DNS black hole list, everybody knows them. They are sort of the first technique specifically invented to fight spam. The way this works is you collect a list of problem hosts respective to your problem, and your problem is fighting spam or viruses. So you collect hosts that you think have a spam problem, and you publish that list somehow on the internet. And you can imagine other ways to publish these lists, but for some reason they chose to publish that via the domain name system. And every mail server on the internet can query those lists, and if a host is listed, then according to the theory, you can just block email from that host. Now, in the beginning, this was sort of reasonable. The first DNS black hole list was the MAPS RBL. And they had a very conservative policy. They did inspections all manually, and they tried to contact the offending, the hostmaster of the offending site, and tried to explain the problem. And then if they did not react in a reasonable way, they ended up being listed. And that was reasonable. In those days, most of the people on the internet used send mail, and send mail back in those days was by default configured as an open relay, so there was a lot of open relays on the internet being abused to send spam. And so the MAPS RBL was sort of as much a spam fighting mechanism as much as an education program to educate people about the problem of open relays. And the open relay problem nowadays is pretty much gone. Even SendMail and all the other MTAs that you use have safe default configuration, more or less. And if you have an open relay or a related problem, you really got there on purpose. The spam problem nowadays is zombies. Most of spam is nowadays sent through zombies. I've heard figures about 80% or more. And this is only going to get worse. Zombies are hosts, just regular dial-up PCs that are taken over by a virus and are commanded by whoever wants to send junk email. And it's nowadays it's impossible to do manual inspections just because of the sheer volume. The internet has grown a lot over the last 10 years, and that's why most of the DNS black hole lists nowadays are fully automated. There are some where you can actually, everything you submit is automatically listed, and everything you nominate for deletion is automatically deleted, so that's particularly bad. Some of them do, most of them actually do some kind of testing. They do some kind of relay testing. They send out an email, and if they get it back, then that's it. You get listed. So that's the situation. Why is that a problem? The problem with these things is that they do not discriminate between temporary problems and permanent problems, or between ill will, if you like. And for that reason, even if you just have a problem of 5 minutes and you get tested during that time, then you might get you might be listed and you cannot get off that list, or you don't even know that you're listed, or it might take you weeks to get off a list, or you might even have to pay for that. And probably for reasons related to that, or for whatever other reasons, large ISPs get regularly blocked by these lists. I know in Germany, GMX is blocked by everybody. For reasons I don't understand. I mean, they have smart people there probably too. But as I said, most of the spam is nowadays not sent through regular email servers that are open relays or have some problem of that sort, but instead they're sent through zombies on dial-up accounts. And tracking dial-up accounts through a DNS-based listing system is more or less useless because, first of all, most dial-up users change dial-in again every day, every 24 hours, and never get a new IP address. And on top of that, DNS has a propagation delay of about 24 hours, so most of your data, and if you choose to track dial-up accounts at all in your DNS black hole list, then most of the data in there is just out of date by 24 hours on average. Or if you do not track dial-up accounts in your list, then you know you miss out on, if you believe my numbers, 80% of your spam problems. So really what this comes down to is that DNS black hole lists nowadays have a low correlation with the actual occurrence of spam or junk email, meaning both not exactly all of your listings are a spam problem because you just list them because of some configuration problem that may or may not actually result in spam occurrence. And on the other hand, you also miss a lot of spam sources on these dial-up accounts. So you really have both a high false positive and a high false negative rate, and that is really the worst combination. On top of that, DNS as a protocol, as a distribution mechanism for information is pretty insecure. I don't want to get into the detail of that. There are entire conferences on why DNS is insecure and what to do about that. It is, in a way, it's amazing that this has not become a problem really in large scale. But you can imagine all kinds of attacks, denial of service attacks, or adding or removing information on these lists by just hacking into DNS. So my opinion on all this is that using DNS black hole lists in the original way, if it's listed, then you just block the communication with that host altogether. That is completely inappropriate today. DNS black hole lists do remain useful in a sort of secondary way. You can use them in some sort of a weighted scoring system like Spam Assassin has, where a listing is sort of gets like 1 point or a low point percentage of the entire points that you need to block an email. I guess they're still useful in that way to figure in with all these other spam filter mechanisms that you have, but by themselves, I think they're entirely inappropriate and will get even more so as the zombie problem continues to grow. The second problem, and I think everybody has experienced that, bounce messages gone wild. Why is that? This is the, on top you see the original concept of how email was supposed to work. So first host A wants to send a message to host B. And then host B checks the message if it likes it. And this usually involves at least checking the recipient address to see if it's a local user or if it's an unauthorized relay attempt. And then host B says either it accepts the message and sends it to the final destination or it rejects the message. And then host A can react to that rejection and in turn inform the user and that the message did not get through. The problem with that is that as you add spam filters, virus filters, or what have you in step two, the checking keeps taking longer and longer, and then host A starts to time out so you don't get any email through at all. So what people did, they thought up this new concept down there. Host A sends a message to host B, and then host B does little or no checking at all. They still check for unauthorized relay attempts usually, but that's really all they do, and then they put the message in the queue, and then the so-called after-queue filtering, they check the message whenever they want later on when the load is low or forward it to a different host and do the checking there in a sort of parallelized fashion. And then when host B or the cluster nodes behind them decide that the message is unacceptable, they supposedly send a rejection message to the sender, but if you know the email protocols at all, there's now no chance at all anymore to actually know who the sender was. So this does not work. So as you all know, all junk email fake sender addresses. So all these rejection messages go to innocent users. So there's a 100% failure rate of this mechanism. And in addition to that, users are now starting, or have already started a while ago, to actually reject rejection messages, filter rejection messages as a sort of spam on their own part. I know, well, there's different ways to do that. I know some people who actually just reject all bounce messages completely, and that, of course, reduces the reliability of the whole email system dramatically. I have thought of my own way, which only works on my own host, and you probably have figured out, too, how you can filter your email, your bounce messages from your email, but it's really hard to do in general. So what do you do, going back to this, what do you do if you do not want to send a rejection message in step three down there? There's alternatives. Well, you can just discard all the messages you don't like. That, of course, reduces the reliability of the email system. Also, you can do that on your private server, I guess, but if you are responsible for an ISP or an organization, then that's, of course, inappropriate. A quarantine system where you keep the email in a sort of separate mailbox, and if it turns out that the filter system got it wrong, you can still get it out of there. That works reasonably well in balance. If you have a sort of a limited user population, then this is manageable. But if you're just a large ISP, then you can't just, you know, keep a quarantine for all your users and have, you know, a staff of dozens of people manage the quarantine. There's also privacy issues with that too. So what to do? Well, fix the MTA timeouts. That's what I would suggest doing, and that is actually possible because most of the time the MTA is not your Outlook client, which you obviously cannot fix, but it's some sort of a different, it's a different MTA which forwards it to the next MTA. And that one you can, of course, configure, or if it's open source, you can just fix the code. Or that is easily doable. The other problem, and it actually is the worst problem here, is that the spam filter, most spam filter software is just terribly implemented and has loads of features. It's bloatware, and it's poorly implemented in terms of performance and scalability. And that's why these timeouts happen that I talked about here. So what I suggest we tackle in the near future is just fixing filter programs for performance. We have now pretty much, in the last couple of years, we got a new filter technique every other week, so we kept adding onto that and added new configuration options, so because people can configure it every way they want to now. And now it has more or less settled down in a way, I think. And so what I would suggest now, the next step should be there, is to fix the performance of filtering software so we can go back to the original concept and actually do the checking here in, where is it, at this point, and do not have to do this fake after queue filtering. What is particularly concerning here is that even a lot of software still operates in this mode down here, that they send rejection messages to the fake sender addresses. And this is not only commercial software which are clueless or just reacting to marketing demands. Even popular open source software like Amavis is still configured by default to send rejection messages as of a couple of weeks ago. And that's a scandal in my mind. So you know how to do this, but configure your software correctly. Graylisting. Graylisting is actually nice, but there's problems with that too. How graylisting works is if you install a graylisting mechanism on your mail server, then the mail server sends to all new emails, sends a temporary error on first contact, which would be a 400 type of error code. And then a normal SMTP client is instructed to try again later, and that's usually in about 15 minutes or so. But spamming software, especially these virus-borne zombie spammy software, does not do that. So that email is just lost, which is what you want. And that turns out to be extremely effective. In some installations we manage, we've seen just the email volume drop by 80% just because of that. And I've seen other reports of other people, approximately those same numbers. When I first of all heard about graylisting about two and a half years ago, I thought, well, this is nice, but in about 3 months, people are going to spam us, they're going to fix our software, and this is all going to be over. But for some reason, they have not. I don't know any spammers, so I don't know why they did that. I can only imagine that this is not a problem for them. So graylisting is not used as much as one would like, but the problems with graylisting are many. As I said, the concept is sound in a way, even though you're abusing the protocol in a way, it's still correct. You're still dealing with the protocol correctly with the letter of the standard. But there are a lot of configuration problems that you might encounter. The first problem that we encountered about two and a half years ago is that most of graylisting software is just really poorly implemented. When the concept came out, the concept is really simple, and you can implement that in about a couple of hours, I guess. But getting it right with all the corner cases is a problem. And everybody wanted to have the graylisting implementation out in a few weeks, I suppose, and they were just full of security problems, buffer overflows, SQL injection, and everything you've seen. And most of those were just two or three files of C code, and if you find about three or four security exploits in each file, that's a problem. The other thing, they don't scale particularly well, and really, if you consider graylisting, really check out what software you're using, because a lot of it is just really bad. If you have some kind of, if you're a large organization, you probably have some kind of server pools or clusters or something of that sort, either on the sender or on the recipient side, and those cause problems. If you have a sender pool, if you have a server pool on the sender side, as many large ISPs, for example, AOL is the canonical example for that, they have that. Then on the remail attempt, on the second attempt to send the email, you have probably a different source IP address, and then the host would get graylisted again. So what you do here is usually that you do not, in your graylisting database, you do not enter the IP address, but that you enter maybe the class C network of the whole sender IP address. And you have to keep a list of for which networks you have to do that. It's a manual hassle. On the recipient side, you have the inverse problem. If on the remail attempt, your connection goes to a different node in your server pool, then that server might not know that the email already got there 15 minutes earlier. So what you have to do there is, either you could imagine that you do a kind of, you do not do a round robin or load balancing in the strict sense, but you decide which node to go through based on the source IP address. That might work, but it doesn't work if you have a server pool on the sender side. So what you have to do is you sort of have to share your graylisting database between all those nodes, which is, of course, a scalability problem. Then there's broken MTAs, which do not retry after a temporary error. There's the canonical example for that is the Yahoo Groups site. And you might think you do not care about Yahoo Groups, but maybe your users do. So, and there's more of that, too. There's the other problem is related to that is mailing listing software, which has a new sender address on each sending attempt. They put some sort of numbers or some sort of code into the sender address. And you have to keep a list of sites that do that too. So you have now about these four different cases, and there's more, but those are the canonical cases in a way. You have to keep a whitelist or at least a list of sites that do that in order not to, so they can circumvent your graylisting implementation. And there's a list you can download of that from graylisting.org, but you would think that list would have stabilized. But if you look, they have a CBS there or an SVN maybe nowadays, and they keep committing into that with new entries every other day. So you really have to stay on top of these things. Another problem with graylisting is, in general, is time-critical emails. For example, the canonical example of that is the eBay emails that your auction is or your bid is about to expire or what have you. And well, what you could do there is you could also whitelist email from eBay, but then, of course, 50% of all spam probably fake sender addresses with the eBay domain. So that really would not work well. So if you have time-critical emails with eBay or some other large site, I guess you can't really use graylisting. Another, well, rarer problem is multi-stage relays. If you just have a series of servers that your email goes through, of course, you should not graylist in each one of them. That is just something you have to consider also in the configuration. So what I think, well, if on your private server or on your small group, maybe graylisting works, or if you have if you manage a server of a company, and you know all people only use email for company purposes, and you can, they don't use eBay at work, maybe graylisting is appropriate, but just for general ISP, or if you have a diverse user population which have different needs, I think graylisting just can't be used reasonably, which is unfortunate, but do be careful if you consider graylisting. The latest but one idea to fight spam is SPF, which is used to stand for sender permitted from, now it stands for sender policy framework. And the way this works is the owner of a domain can control which mail servers you can use for email. As it stands now, you can send email through any mail server you want to, subject to authentication or relaying checks. But now the owner of a domain, the one who registers the domain, can publish a so-called SPF record, again via the domain name system, for lack of a better alternative. And that record identifies, lists all the valid servers that you are allowed to send outgoing mail through for this domain. And then under the theory, every recipient of email checks for SPF records of the sender address. And under the strict theory, we would then reject email that comes from senders, from hosts that are not valid outgoing mail servers for that domain. And a lot of sites actually do hard rejections based on that. Then there's actually two alternatives or two separate implementations of this idea. The original SPF checks the envelope sender address. There is the alternative sender ID, which is championed by Microsoft, which has a different internal record format too. They do not check the sender envelope address, they check the email content, so they would check all these different lines, sender, from, and all these things, and would kind of try to guess which is the most likely sender address. Those are two different ways to go about that. Sender ID has the problem that there's also patent problems and licensing problems from Microsoft, so it's not used all that much outside of Microsoft. But they're sort of the same idea. The problem with SPF, it doesn't fight any spam at all. Because if you're a spammer, then you would just use a different domain. If you are, you have a, as a spammer, you have a list of email addresses or domains that you might like to use in your fake your sender email address scheme. And then for spammer, it's trivial to just, before using a domain, check if there's an SPF record, and if there is, just don't use it. So that's fully automated, and I suppose spammers do that, so that's just a total waste of time then. Of course, spammers can also publish their own SPF records, and they do that. They register their own domains for the purpose of, you know, what they selling their products, and they can publish SPF records for their own domain, hosting their shops. So there's absolutely nothing that SPF, if spammers are not completely stupid and send spam using domains that have SPF records, if they're not that stupid, then SPF does not do anything at all against spam. If you go to the SPF website, which is opensPF.org nowadays, you will see what they actually say is SPF is a sender policy framework to prevent email forgery. So they actually, if you read between the lines, they know it doesn't fight spam, it only prevents email forgery. And it actually does that in a way, but you might think SPF does something against phishing, but if you think about it, the envelope address, nobody ever sees the envelope address. In your email client, you don't see the envelope address, so it does not do anything that the user can notice. There's no noticeable difference for the user whether the email sender address of the email was forged or not. So that's also pretty useless. Sender ID is better in that regard. I don't have any practical experience with sender ID, but it would seem to be a better approach to actually fight this phishing problem. What SPF does prevent in a way is the following. If you're an ISP and you have a domain, and for large ISPs, the domain is often abused for email forgery attacks, so AOL and all these kinds of things. You have sender addresses with AOL, which are faked. And by publishing an SPF record, the ISP can sort of prevent that people do that. So if you publish an SPF record, and if you're a spammer and you follow that advice up there, then people would use a different domain. So you kind of protect your own domain against being abused by faking email address schemes. And that is really the only thing that it does. And I suppose that's the reason why these large ISPs publish SPF records, all of them together, because it kind of protects the integrity or the reputation of their domain. But it does not do anything at all against the actual phishing problem or virus or sending spam. On the other hand, what it does is it breaks the conventional email protocols in various ways. For example, it breaks forwarding. Forwarding meaning something like your .forward file that you forward from your own one Unix account maybe to a different email address, or from your .procmailrc configuration or any other kind of forwarding scheme like that. Because then your own, this host that you forward from would probably no longer be an authorized sending email host in that domain, unless you can convince your large ISP to add your own personal machine into their SPF records, which is not likely to happen. And there is supposed to be a way around that, the sender rewriting scheme, which nobody has implemented so far. There's patches out there for all the different MTAs, but it's not available really. So it basically just breaks forwarding right now. What ISPs can now do is they can control which way people send email. If you until now you could pick any email server you want to for sending your email, but now if you use the domain of your ISP, if you have some sort of username at, I don't know, t-online or whatever email address, the ISP can now say you have to send your email through this mail server that we like and we put there. And that is a problem, that could be a problem for you for various reasons. For example, if that particular email server, through stupidity, is on a DNS black hole list, you have no way around that anymore now. Because if you send it a different route, then the sender might block it because of your SPF records. And they can also do other kinds of things. You can imagine they could put advertisements in the bottom of the email, which you can no longer prevent. They can, of course, they can record all your email traffic, and since a week ago, we know that they will record all your email traffic, so you have no way around that anymore. You cannot install your own email server or any of the other suggestions that were offered yesterday in another talk. And again, DNS is a fairly insecure protocol, and the more services we stack on top of DNS, the more likely it is that there's going to be a large-scale problem one of these days. So really, the only thing I have to say about SPF or sender IDs, do not use it. Do not publish any SPF records, because that just encourages people to use them. And do not, under any circumstances, filter your email because of SPF. Unfortunately, now, since Spam Assassin even now does SPF filtering by default, I think, since version 3, so I don't know what they were thinking, but please consider carefully anything you do with SPF. This is the latest idea. Actually, it's a fairly old idea, but this is probably going to happen more nowadays to fight spam. Blocking port 25. This means that on regular dial-up accounts, the ISP blocks the port 25 for outgoing connections. And this is reasonable. If you consider what I said earlier, that most junk email nowadays is sent by zombies, which are cracked home user PCs, and they are using current mechanisms, they are hard to track because the IP address changes every 24 hours, and you do not have any chance to track them through DNS-based black hole lists. And even if you could track them, the spammers couldn't just switch to the next set of zombies. They have thousands and thousands of these machines available, and if the first 1,000 are listed, they just use the next 1,000. And you can rent them, and they are rented out by people. So there's absolutely no problem. Even if you could track zombies, this would not do any significant impact. So what they are proposing now, what they're already doing in certain areas, is that they block the port 25 for outgoing traffic, except to the designated email server of the ISP, which supposedly has some sort of rate controls or some checks of various kinds. So there's a little bit more security. And this is actually not so bad, because it actually indirectly adds more security for the regular end users, the dial-up users of that particular ISP, because a virus writer or someone who tries to target these machines for owning them is really, they're not no longer an attractive target for doing that, because even if you could take control of these machines, you cannot really do the things you want anymore. Of course, there are other things you can do if you have taken control of a PC, but for the purpose of sending out email, they are no longer that attractive. So, of course, viruses do not really discriminate on that level, but there's a certain extra level of security for end users. So, again, as I said, it's not all that a bad idea, but there's, of course, also problems with that. If you want to use email accounts other than the one that your ISP gives you, the regular average users maybe has the dial-up account or the DSL account nowadays, which is also dial-up, at a certain ISP, and also has the email address there. But if you have more than one email account, or you just get your email somewhere else, then you have a problem, because you are forced to send all your email through your ISP, but if you use a different domain, or you have a work account, or you have more accounts for other projects, or where you contract, or what have you, then you have a problem, because you're supposed to use that ISP, that domain's mail server according to their policy, and according to the policy of your ISP, you have to send email through that mail server. The workaround that is proposed or that is implemented is that the ISPs allow you to route any email you want through their mail server, subject to authentication, and that works. But again, now ISPs have the power over you to control where you send your email. You can no longer use your own email server for reasons that I mentioned previously. You can no longer install your own mail server software, your own filtering systems, and if the ISP is blacklisted, you have no way to get around that. Or if you just want to prevent that, all your communication is locked, which it will be. And all of this is also completely incompatible with SPF that I just explained, because SPF tells you have to send your email through what the owner of the domain says. And on the other hand, this concept says that you have to send your email through what the ISP says. And if those two are not talking to each other, which they likely will not, then you have a problem that you just can't send email anymore for certain domains. So what I suggest about this is, and this is will likely happen because people are talking about this now, and in the US for certain email servers, it's already happening. Yes, question?
With SMTPS, the
whole thing will... Yeah, but no, the question was, or the comment was about SMTPS, but I don't know what exactly you mean by that, or how that figures in here. Going through a different port, you mean? Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's really what I was going to say is yesterday, I don't know, what was his name, Brent de Winter, who talked about the data retention legislation in the EU, and he suggested just use a different port. If you send all your stuff through port 26 or 24, then it's not considered email anymore and it's not locked. And the same really applies here. If you can just use a different port, put your own email server out in the internet and use a different port, or use other SMTP-like protocols that go through different ports, and I guess they can also block all the other kinds of ports, obviously. But what this does is, obviously, spammers are interested in spamming people who use port 25, right? So this will actually prevent spam. Of course, you have workarounds. I mean, we always have workarounds. We can tunnel anything through anything. So. But for the average user or people who do not want to spend all their time setting up hosts in different countries and all that, this is going to be a problem, especially if you add up other restrictions like SPF and things that can happen. Of course, we always have workarounds. There's not ever going to be a way where you say, I cannot do anything anymore. But there's just going to be more and more problems that people are facing. So what I would suggest here, if you're interested in that or if you're considering doing that, even if you work in ISP, I would not actually mind if this happened, but then you have to give your users the option of opting out of that with no questions asked and no fees being paid or anything you might consider. So if the user can just go there, call you up, or go into some sort of management interface and say, I do not want my ports blocked, then opt out of that. Then that I think that would work. But, you know, who is going to do that? Large ISPs, they just block everything, and then people are going to be happy, I guess. So I don't know if this is happening in Europe already, but I know this in the US, certain ISPs have at least done that a few years ago and have had problems with that. They do AOL does it in Germany, Europe also? Okay.
It's right, it's been widely done for many years. I've been on this for about 4 or 5 years, something like that.
This has been going on for a while now in certain areas, but I was at a conference in September on spam issues where a lot of government people were there, and they are now discussing making this they can't force you to do it, I guess, or they could try to, but this is going to be sort of like the official recommendation nowadays or something like that. So it might happen in more places.
Personally, I think this was back in the sort of the really big Outlook virus time. I think it helped a lot just on the, you could send mail once they started blocking ports because not everything was filled with junk suddenly. So I think in general it's a good thing just for server load reasons.
Yep. So yeah, this is not bad, but you'd have to give people a way to opt out of that, I would think. So this is just the next thing is challenge response systems, and I think most of you have dealt with these at one time or another. And this is just really bad. It's a kind of gray listing on a different level, if you like. The way it works is when the user of that system would receive an email, they would send you back a challenge email, which most of the time, if you have to answer the challenge, which most of the time is just replying to the email or clicking on the link or maybe you have to solve a puzzle or something like that. But there has to be some kind of show that there was a manual intervention there. And then when the receiver gets that email back, then then the original message gets through. So that easy concept, but it doesn't work. Again, here we know sender addresses are routinely faked, so all these challenge messages just go to innocent users who are annoyed by them. And this has the side effect again, or the nice side effect, you think that users of these challenge response systems are now finding themselves on blacklists for spamming. And so, yeah, this if you believe that spam is now more than 50% of email, then about 50% of there's 50% of just useless, annoying mail being sent to innocent users. Spammers are getting smarter and smarter, and they can actually fake their emails to get around these authentication mechanisms. They can analyze email traffic and figure out who talks to whom and guess what kind of sender addresses are already might already be authenticated or figure other ways around that. So spammers really, if they are a little bit intelligent at all, can figure out ways around these systems. The other problem is just at the concept that apparently two people who use these systems can never start talking to each other because the second system would just send back a challenge and the other guy is not going to accept the challenge. So there has to be some sort of a loopholes in these systems that the challenge messages of the other system can get through your own challenging system without any challenge. And of course, that is you can also exploit that if you are trying to write spam or send some sort of a email through that you do not want to be checked. And challenge response systems would also require installing loopholes in spam filters, so your challenges are not filtered as spam. And anytime you are requiring installing a loophole, loopholes can be exploited. Challenge response systems actually facilitate phishing. Imagine everyone used challenge response systems, and then if you want to phish for email addresses or do anything of that sort, or just want to verify email addresses, you just send someone a challenge message, and if they click OK or respond to it, then you know the email address is live. And so this really would hurt even the more inexperienced users even more than anything else, because then they would just click on everything, and that is, of course, what they're not supposed to do. And then you also have to consider that tracking these challenge response systems, there's emails going back and forth, and you have to keep track of all that. And those systems are installed on your, on the ISP, on the machine of your ISP, and they have keep track of extensive databases. They know when you received email, when you responded to email, and what time you were home, and these things. And that's just more and more data being gathered. So I guess you all know that challenge response systems are counterproductive. They lose email and they really place the burden not on the spammers, but on the regular users, which is the fundamental flaw in this whole system. So I guess you all know that you should not use them. So here are a couple of other, I have to hurry up a little, here are a couple of other ways that people have tried to fight spam, which is kind of weird. I know someone who they figured, well, I do not trust external lists of things to block, which is reasonable. And they figured, well, we do our own, and which of course does not work. You cannot, even if you have a large staff, you cannot keep track of all the email addresses being listed and delisted and all that manually. So that doesn't work. Either use public lists or you don't use them, but don't try to keep track of them yourself. Running a local Paizo server, I did not talk about Paizo. It's kind of a questionable concept in my mind, but running a local Paizo server which only lists emails that you have already identified and then feeding that back into your own spam filter does not work because you do not get any find any more spam or any less spam, you just find the same spam again. Only throw off your whole scoring mechanism if you do it for through spam assessment, for example. Yeah, forgetting the MX backup, I don't think a lot of people use MX backups anymore unless you're sort of a large ISP, but secure in your primary server and not secure in your MX backup is just stupid because spammers spam the MX backup first. Then there are a couple of, some people do that, they just check for any kind of standards violation, or there's rcignorant.org, which is a DNS-based list, or complaining if the subject line is not encoded properly. And well, that is nice if you want to do that, but that doesn't have anything to do with fighting spam. So, you know, don't bother people about that. You can educate people about that on your own time, I guess, but you don't find any spam with checking if the subject line is encoded properly. That has absolutely nothing to do with that, so consider not doing that. And then there was a funny case I saw a couple of weeks ago, actually. There was someone who, or a lot of people do that apparently, they change their email address regularly. They change 2005 to 2006 in the end, and then they send an email to everybody who, so they change their contact information. And if you want to find this particular email that I'm thinking about, you can go to the online mailing list archives of the Debian project, because the email is in the archives there, and any spammer who harvests email from the Debian mailing list archive already has his new email address, so I guess they're getting all the spam again that they got in their old email address. Yeah, so pretty much, of course you can invent your own filters, but chances are they're not going to work, or you're just going to annoy people with your own private ideas, so stick to the ones that people know, so we're all communicating on the same protocols. So that's the technical side. The other problems with the email filtering is the privacy. There's a lot more new data gathered that you might not like people to have. For example, word databases, Bayesian filter word databases, or any kind of statistics that you keep. You can look into that word database and see how many times people talk about Al-Qaeda simply. Graylisting databases also keep track of whom emailed whom at what time, and of course that information is available in different places too. You have the regular server log files already contain that information, but if you go into organizations that you know, they have very strict rules about what to do with their log files. They can only keep them for a certain time, and they have to be encrypted, and they have to be stored away and hidden in a locked room, but they don't know anything about these other databases, the Bayesian databases and the graylisting databases, and they're not secured at all, or they don't even exist officially, and all the information in there is not secured at all. There's what I did not talk about is a filtering mechanism called DCC, Distributed Checksum Clearinghouse, which counts how many times an email has been sent on the internet. And if you follow their theory, then if an email has been sent more than a certain number of times, maybe 1 million, then it might be considered bulk email. And that, I think that works well, but the problem you have there now, if you get an email, you can check how many times that email has been sent. So if you get an email from your business partner for Christmas, as has been popular in the last couple of weeks, and you can check how many times that email has been sent, and then you can see how many business partners that guy has, for example. So that kind of things you also have to consider. I mentioned the challenge response transaction records also being kept and probably not secured. And as I mentioned, using SPF and blocking port 25, one or the other or both, then ISPs can control which way you route your email, and making sure you send it through their server logs, through their server, which is locked, and they forward it directly to the NSA. And all of this is controlled not by you, but by the ISP, and the ISP does not particularly care about your privacy, at least most of them don't. So all this database gathering is done in your ISP, and you cannot control it. Now, if you listen, I mentioned I was at a congress on spam fighting in Köln in September. And apparently what people are doing now, if they start a new spam initiative, the first thing they do is build a database. And nowadays, everybody is building databases. Starting with the spam filter manufacturers, of course, they have big, huge databases of spam just to tune their products, of course. But now you also see governments and industry associations building databases of spam, and they ask you to forward their spam to them. Maybe you've heard of the Federal Trade Commission in the US. They have an email address where you can forward spam. And in Germany, it's rather new. You have the ECO, which is the association of German Internet Enterprises, and the Wettbewerbszentrale, which is a fair trade organization in Germany. And this is just a couple of examples in other countries too, likely. And with that, you don't know what they do with that. Once they gather that, they can, you know, they know at what time you were home and who tried to email you and what email client you use and what IP address you had at a particular time. And ever since the EU data retention directive, this is sort of trivial, I guess, but these are additional databases that keep getting built and which allow people to profile you. And these are going to be shared internationally. There's already a so-called European Spambox project underway, which basically discusses or protocols or ways these all these databases can be shared, so you get more databases and bigger databases. And those are impossible to control. If you think about these things that are now being discussed in for the EU Data Retention Directive, those things will likely be able to control and be able to be controlled in some way, because they are sort of an official database being established for purpose of tracking criminals, supposedly. But these databases are just voluntary in a way, and nobody can control what is being done with them. There is, fortunately, recourse in a... This is based on German law, but it's likely similar in most of the EU because it's based on EU directions. Spam filtering in general is not allowed without the user's consent, and that is... it's different for virus filtering. Virus filtering is... ISPs can do that as a sort of a self-defense mechanism. But spam filtering is not allowed at all without the user's consent. And this not only includes discarding... spam. This includes adding headers and changing the subject line, or even just gray listing and delivering the email 15 minutes later. All of this is not allowed based on telecommunications regulation and Fernmeldegeheimnis and these things. So what ISPs must do is they have to tell people about what they are doing with their email. This is usually probably hidden somewhere in the business rules or allgemeine Geschäftsbedingungen or things like that, or people have to activate filters themselves by checking some sort of a box, please filter my email. So you really have the opportunity to know what is going on with your email in terms of filtering or restricting it or changing it. As usual in these cases, most users are not going to care. The regular end user is just glad that they don't get any spam and they will check, filter on my email. But so this is sort of a call to you, maybe the more experienced users, to spread the word and then tell people what is happening with their email and where their data is being collected and in which ways their communication is being restricted. So to conclude, in my opinion, email is very unreliable already today. Much of this, what I've talked about, is also based on personal experiences just in my own email box. Users are starting to accept that email is unreliable. They say, well, I don't think I got your email. I think my spam filter ate it. Could you send it again, or could you call me up? And this is really a bad development. People are looking for alternatives to email. They are using instant messaging or sending fax, using the fax machine or voice over IP or what have you, or SMS. To blame are, of course, those people who send spam or viruses, but I think the application, the of inappropriate junk email filters, annoying people through challenge response systems or bounce messages or restricting their communications in certain ways. If you can't send email on the first try because something is blocked, chances are you're not going to try again. Just call the person up. So if you are implementing email filters, check what you're doing first. Do not install everything. Do not believe everything Spam Assassin installs for you, or do not believe all the options that your program gives you. Check what each technique is doing and how this impacts yourself and your users. Check all the, if you work in an ISP, check all the databases that you have that they're secured. Check that the gray listing database is secured and all these other things. And check what your ISP is doing with your email or the email of your associates. Okay, that is all. Any important questions? Because I think we have to kind of clear out for the next people. Okay, thanks.